We've seen this movie before, Donald Trump talking up a ceasefire initiative, only for the killing to continue in Gaza. Killing that's been relentless of late, off the scales ever since a U.S. and Israeli aid delivery scheme that bypasses traditional international agencies. We'll ask about Trump's claim that Israel has agreed to his 60-day truce, the reaction of Hamas that's down but not completely out, and what's changed since Benjamin Netanyahu walked away in March from a phased agreement that was to lead to a permanent ceasefire and the release of remaining hostages. What's changed? Well, for starters, Israel's 12-day war with Iran, where it was the U.S. president that told Netanyahu to declare victory and go home. Will Trump twist the Israeli leader's arm again when Netanyahu travels to Washington next week? All bets are off. Will it be the Donald Trump who gushes about a Gaza Riviera construction scheme, or the one who forces Netanyahu's hand by announcing Iran negotiations or the recognition of Syria's government? More broadly, when is enough enough? Today in the France 24 debate, how hard will Trump push for that Gaza ceasefire? With us from Washington, Hussein Ibish, senior resident scholar at the Arab Gulf States Institute. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, François.
Also in the U.S. Capitol, Nigar Mordasavi, journalist, senior fellow at the Center for International Policy. Thanks for joining us again.
Thanks for having me.
Tel Aviv pollster and political analyst Mitchell Barak is with us. Thank you for being with us again.
Thank you. I'm in Jerusalem, though.
In Jerusalem. Thanks for the correction. And from the village of Ribeauvillé in the eastern Alsace region of France, Ronan Koehler, a colonel in Israel's Navy Reserve and one of the founders of the civic aid group Brothers and Sisters in Arms. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, thank you. Very happy to be here. Good evening.
Reminder, you can listen to the France 24 debate wherever podcasts are streamed. Yeah, it's been sometimes dozens killed per day of late, entire neighborhoods told to evacuate, and a life-threatening embargo. Dateline, for instance, Gaza City's Al-Shifa Hospital, where on Tuesday a shortage of fuel forced the suspension of services inside the dialysis unit.
I need dialysis. Due to the lack of solar power and water, the dialysis process has stopped. Without dialysis, the levels of fluid and toxins in our blood increase. We suffocate, we can't sleep, we lose our appetite, we can't move. It's very difficult.
Hussein Ibish, how much coverage is Gaza getting where you are?
Not much, and definitely not enough. Only when Trump says something, you know, they report, okay, President Trump has said something. But I think the killing in Gaza, which, as you say, is kind of off the charts, has also become routinized. In American media, it's a dog bites man story. It's just considered normal somehow. And that's really tragic because you're talking about an incredible situation where food distribution has been turned, I'm not saying deliberately, but in effect into a mousetrap where people are lured into food distribution centers and then shot down. And you've had 600 or so people shot at these food distribution centers, by Israeli forces mainly since late May. And also, bombing attacks that have wiped out, to 40 people here, 25 people there. It's pretty extraordinary. So I do think, to a very large extent, the war has just become background noise. And that's outrageous.
Yeah, you mentioned those food distribution points. More and more Israeli soldiers have been speaking out. The military denying Sunday's report in daily newspaper Haaretz, where active duty soldiers describe orders to shoot at unarmed soldiers. One of them saying, it's a killing field where I was stationed. Between 1 and 5 people were killed every day. They're treated like a hostile force. No crowd control measures, no tear gas, just live fire with everything imaginable, heavy machine guns, grenade launchers, mortars. Then once the center opens, the shooting stops and they know they can approach. Our form of communication is gunfire, end quote. Ronan Kuller, have you been able to speak with active duty soldiers of late? Has there been a tipping point reached?
I think that the tipping point is reached. I think that what's happening in Gaza is right now going nowhere. It's going nowhere for the people who live there. It's going nowhere for the IDF. You know, there are soldiers being, Israeli soldiers being killed almost every day for, I want to say, for no reason or for no real task. And it's a terrible tragedy for both sides, and this war needs to end as soon as possible. I totally agree. It's a tragedy, and I agree that it's somehow routinized and people are becoming blunt to it, and it's and it has a huge impact on our own people, because many of these reservists have been there for 500 days and they are already in a bad shape themselves, and adding that is terrible.
And these orders to shoot, can you corroborate that?
I haven't been there. I don't know if there are orders to shoot. I think it's a war situation that has nothing to do with real fighting, and everybody is stressful. I don't want to sound as if I'm justifying it. It's a situational it's a situation that is no one can really deal with. Not any young soldier or reservist can deal with it. I don't think that anyone is doing it on purpose, but I definitely think that this situation is terrible.
Mitchell Barak, there was there have been 20 killed, 20 Israeli soldiers killed in the last month, and especially since the ceasefire with Iran. There are those, particularly last week when there were 7 Israelis soldiers killed in Gaza, there was the sense now it's going to become another Iraq, another Fallujah, where we're bogged down, that it's gone on for too long. Is that a general feeling? What do your surveys say?
I don't know. Bogged down. I mean, Iraq and Fallujah are thousands of miles away from the United States of America. What I find amazing about the program so far is we're about 5-6 minutes into it. No one has mentioned the people who are in charge of Gaza, who were elected by the people of Gaza, and that's the Islamic Resistance Movement, the Hamas, who spent the last 20 years in government and spent most of the money, the aid money, and their know-how and their tenacity, and try to kill Israelis and to build tunnels. And, you know, like you said, 7 Israelis were killed just last week. They don't give up. And the amazing thing is you keep running the loop of pictures of these children and older women getting food. The pictures that we see here all the time are the Hamas operatives standing with guns on the trucks as soon as they come in. As soon as they get in, they take over that food, that humanitarian aid. That's what's holding this up, and that's what the problem is. And that's who most of the people are that are getting shot are those that are taking the trucks over and stealing all the food. But and you haven't even told the story here. You show those pictures. It's ridiculous.
The death toll has increased.
This is not a quagmire. The reason this could all stop tomorrow. It could all stop in December when I was on this program. All the Islamic Resistance Movement has to do is release the hostages that they have left and say, it's time to rebuild Gaza. Let's find someone else who can run the place. But they're not going to say that, and they're not going to give up. And they're going to continue to attack the Israeli soldiers that are there like they did last week. And they're going out of their tunnels, and they're still going to do that. That's what we're up against. It's not like a quagmire here.
One at a time.
First, Mitchell Barak.
Ideologically committed to killing Israelis. They built 250 miles of tunnels. You could probably get a tunnel from Paris to London underground with the tunnels that they have. That's what they've been doing, and that's what Israel is fighting, and that's what people understand here. Now, there are people that want to get the hostages back and say that's right now the greatest priority. But everyone agrees that the Hamas has to be finished. We can't have spent the last year and a half there so that Hamas comes out the day after, claims victory, and continues to shoot any dissidents, and especially their favorite time of the year now, June, which is Gay Pride Month, where they like to hang those homosexuals on the telephone poles or just break them, break their knees and shoot them in the streets like they do.
Hussein Ibish.
Yeah. So in English, we call this whataboutism. Right. It is when you excuse bad behavior. No, Mitchell, listen to me. It is when you excuse bad behavior by pointing to other people's bad behavior. No one, I think, is going to defend Hamas. Hamas is thugs and gangsters. OK, no doubt about that. But that doesn't excuse Israel from the mass killing of Palestinians. And by the way, I agree that ordinary Israeli soldiers are not doing this on purpose, but the Haaretz report specifies Brigadier General Yehuda Vach, commander of the IDF's Division 252, as being specifically involved in the mass shooting of people coming to these aid centers. Look, Israel's behavior cannot be excused by pointing at Hamas. That's ridiculous. And Hamas could point at Israel, and does, and says, oh, well, look at us, we're under occupation, and we have the right to resist, and therefore we can go and shoot people in their homes and take people hostage. It's ridiculous. This kind of logic leads to endless killing and death, and it's not right. None of this justifies war crimes, murders, and mass killings on either side. No way.
Enter Donald Trump, who, ahead of an Oval Office meeting next Monday, swiftly announced late on Tuesday that Benjamin Netanyahu is ready to sign on the dotted line. Trump saying that there'd be a 60-day ceasefire. We'll work with all parties to end the war. He, by the way, adds, I hope for the good of the Middle East that Hamas takes this deal because it will not get better. And capital letters, Negar Mortazavi, it will only get worse. Kind of sounds a little bit like the playbook with Iran when you read it like that. But in other statements that he's made, Negar, the U.S. president has said he'd come down hard on Benjamin Netanyahu, too. Does this seem like what we've seen before, or have times changed since the Israel-Iran war?
Well, it looks like what we've seen before. I want to clarify here. I think the U.S. president himself wants an end to the war. He got elected calling himself a president of peace, promising that he would bring peace to the Middle East, as well as between Russia and Ukraine. And the reason behind that is that the majority of the Americans are opposed to these wars in the Middle East and the U.S. getting bogged down, you know, with material support, arms, financials, and then potentially getting pulled into the war like it we saw with the Israel-Iran war that the U.S. had to eventually enter. So I think the intention has been there, but what I don't think the administration realized is the power of interest groups, of neocons within the president's own party, the Republican Party, and of course, U.S.'s closest ally in the region, which is Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu, and how much they have sort of influence within the administration, within the Republican Party, and against the anti-war wing of the party, which is the MAGA, the America First. So I don't know how the two are going to come this time around. The ceasefire hasn't happened. It's been a few months since the president came to the office with the promise of peace in the Middle East. He attracted Arab American votes, Muslim American votes, that helped him potentially win in Michigan, a battleground state, and other places around the U.S. with this promise of peace, not just in Gaza, but Lebanon and in the Middle East. And that hasn't really happened, I think, because of sort of that counter push of the other side, the powerful various different within the U.S. Congress also, and of course, the Republican Party. And so who wins this time? I'm not sure, but I think the episode with Iran maybe did sort of signal or show or warn the MAGA wing that if the war in the region, essentially in Gaza, that conflict doesn't end, it can easily
because it was specifically,
to other regions and also potentially pull the U.S. in.
There was specifically that F-bomb moment where it was touch and go for the ceasefire, Negar. And as he was about to travel to the NATO summit, Donald Trump issued an explicative-laden warning to both Israel and Iran to cut it out. Is that emboldening him this time around?
Maybe so. I mean, the way he tweeted or Truth Social that the Israeli planes need to turn around, and with the pressure came actually the turning around and an enforcement of the ceasefire with some challenge. I think maybe that would be sort of the model here. That can be potentially the model. I mean, the United States has immense power. And if the U.S. president wants to exercise that power and influence over its own ally, you know, pressure the Israelis, there's all kinds of leverage that the U.S. has. It's just no one's ever wanted to use it to the maximum. If he wants to use that power, that influence, you know, some say the U.S. can end the war in Gaza with just one phone call, the U.S. president. So he does have that power. It's just how you see that balance of power playing out here in Washington. This also plays into domestic politics in the U.S. as well.
All right. Benjamin Netanyahu, who's got to take care of his own domestic politics. He's got a coalition that includes a far right that's dead set against any kind of a truce. He sent a muscular message this Wednesday while on a visit to the southern Israeli city of Ashkelon.
I'm telling you, there will be no Hamas. There will be no Hamas Stan. We're not going back to that. It's over. We'll release all our hostages and we will defeat Hamas.
So Ronan Kohler, we on this show try to avoid too much trying to read what's inside Donald Trump's mind, but tell us a little bit about what's inside Benjamin Netanyahu's mind. Is this just staking out his turf ahead of a negotiation, or do we take him at his word and that dims the prospect of an eventual ceasefire?
I think that so far all what I've heard from the different army and defense analysts is that the chief of staff himself, General Eyal Zamir, said specifically that the army has reached the goals that they set to themselves in Gaza. So anything more than that requires changing the goals or the targets to achieve. And so in that sense, I think that even from the inside the military organizations, it's very clear that if you want to do something else in Gaza, something that we haven't been doing in the last 630 days or plus more than 630 days, I don't know what that can be. So the definition, I think, in my opinion, as a citizen, as a reservist, the definition of we will defeat. The question, what is defeat, is the critical question. And I think that right now the question of defeating Hamas is much more kind of a political and public relations and, you know, a picture of victory question rather than a real military type question. And I think that's probably going to be part of the discussion on the ceasefire. It's like, how can they show that we won and they can show that they were not defeated, and et cetera.
Do you sense that with the 12-day war with Iran, that Israel was able to declare victory?
Over Iran?
Yes.
I think so, yes. I think that over Iran, we did whatever we could, and I also want to say, I think whatever we needed to do. I don't think that anything else, unless... Obviously, I'm not exposed to the very deep intelligence, but based on what I saw, what I read, and what I know, we have done a phenomenal job, a job that should have been done and should have been ended at the time it was ended.
Mitchell Barak, you have an Israeli prime minister who, again, has to deal with a coalition that includes the far right. They could make his coalition fall if there's a truce, unless he finds other partners to form a government. What are his options? Particularly, I'm seeing a report in the Times of Israel this Wednesday that, quoting Arab sources, that there could be some kind of a rekindling of a normalization of ties with Saudi Arabia should a ceasefire lead to something better. Can Benjamin Netanyahu sell a truce to his coalition?
Well, first of all, he's in a different place than he was a month ago. A month ago, I don't think he was in a political position within his government to make any kind of agreement for a ceasefire that would be accepted. His base and not use the opposition parties to pass it through. And that would be a problem because they threatened to leave at that point. Once he had this really decisive victory in against the Islamic Republic of Iran, which many Israelis agree was a victory, both because of what Israel did alone, the extent of the damage to their nuclear program, and then, boom, President Trump sends those B-2 bombers in to finish the job. That was a fantastic military victory in Israeli eyes, as well as geopolitical, that the United States joined, even though it ended abruptly when President Trump said so. So he's got a lot of leeway now and a lot of strength and a lot of political capital based on that, that he can make a deal. And they wouldn't be that smart to bring down the government because people realize there is a greater picture to Gaza, even though they can disagree on what the goals are in Gaza right now and how much of a blow you have to give the Hamas. The point is they see the geopolitical picture of Iran is now destroyed, Hezbollah, the party of God, is destroyed, Hafez Assad is in Moscow somewhere, and all of these threats against Israel and Hamas have collapsed. So there's a geopolitical, what's next? And Netanyahu is the best person in the position to do that with President Donald Trump.
Yeah, but he still has to contend with people like Ben-Gavir, Smotrich, and are you saying their bark is worse than their bite, or are you suggesting that he'll have to find other partners?
Now it is. And also, he may be able to shore up some more political support and some other political parties. We see that Gantz's party is collapsing. Two of his people are leaving. So, you know, all that is possible as far as he may even be able to bring more people in because he was able to unite many Israelis by this decisive action against the Islamic Republic of Iran. And it really made Israel look like we are very powerful nation. And a lot of people around the world, even in your country of France, believe it or not, are probably happy that the Iranians are not achieving nuclear status. But at the end of the day, the bottom line is, it's whatever President Trump wants, President Trump gets. On January 20th, Israel stopped having independent foreign policy. Netanyahu is very close to him. They'll have a great meeting. He'll try and convince Trump whatever he's going to try and convince, whatever Trump wants to do, which is expand the Abraham Accords and make the region look more normal. And he's big into trade, and he's a transactional president. All of this stuff, and he's going to push for it. And Netanyahu's going to come back and he's going to tell the right-wing folks in his government, some of them don't make a lot of sense, that, hey, this is what President Trump wants. We've got Iran. We've done what we can with Gaza. It's time to move forward. And they're going to give him a full support. I don't see anyone leaving the government under these circumstances after the last 3 weeks.
All right, Mitchell Barak, they're saying whatever President Trump wants, he gets. Let me ask you, Hussein Ibish, if we can just do a second of forensics here on what happened between Israel and Iran. Yep. I know that, like Ronan Koehler, you're not privy to all the military intelligence.
Right. But sadly not.
But in that particular case, when you saw how it started, was it Netanyahu calling the shots? Was it not? In which case, is it Netanyahu at the end of the day dictates Donald Trump's foreign policy when it comes to the Middle East?
No, I don't think either of them dictate each other's policies. I think Trump has more leverage over Netanyahu than vice versa. But it depends how much pressure and how much political capital Trump is willing to put into pressuring Netanyahu on a given issue. He did not want Netanyahu to go to war with Iran at the moment that Netanyahu did. He was pursuing an interesting idea about Iran maybe joining a regional consortium or promising to join a regional consortium, which could have squared the circle where Iran would promise to give up the right to enrich at some future date pending the creation of some consortium that doesn't exist and may never exist, so that you could say they gave up the right to enrich, but then they could continue to enrich at a low level, 3.67%, for energy, for electricity, and claim they did, that they didn't give it up. And that was an interesting idea. That was the moment Israel struck. I think they were worried that that could possibly be the entree into a deal. However, Trump was interested in letting Netanyahu do what he could and see what happened. He was not passionately against it. So when he found that he couldn't talk Netanyahu out of it, he stepped back, let the Israelis see what they could do. I agree with everyone else here. It was very successful from the Israeli point of view. And at the last minute, Trump swooped in and did two things. He grabbed some of the glory. He certainly didn't complete the job. There's a lot more that the original American plan for actually destroying Iran's nuclear facilities. I mean, that would have been the first salvo of at least a couple of weeks of similar attacks. But it did do significant damage to one of their major sites, Fordo, and a couple of others. And so he managed to take some of the glory. And at the same time, he was able to stop the war. And that opens up the possibility for him to get the Iranians back to the table, which is what he really wants, because in the end, you kind of have to convince them to voluntarily give up this quest, or eventually, some way or another, they will acquire this bomb. And I think everyone agrees they shouldn't have one. So this is where we are. We're in a situation where, yes, Trump has a lot more leverage over Netanyahu than vice versa, but it depends how much he wants to push. If Netanyahu won't listen to him and Trump won't push very much, then Netanyahu can continue to do what he wants. My sense is on Gaza that it's going to be Hamas that's going to ultimately say no to this if anyone does. It's possible that both sides would agree, but all you'll get is 60 days, because I think Netanyahu is very clear. This war is going to continue. He wants the war to continue. I'm not convinced Hamas wants the war to end either, frankly, at least not enough. So, I'm not sure Trump is going to get his way on ending the war. He might get a respite of a couple of months, but an actual end to the war, he's going to have to put a lot more pressure on Netanyahu and sweeten the deal for Hamas in terms of ending the war. And creating like a pathway to actually ending the war and getting Israeli soldiers out of Gaza, which is, I think, anathema to Netanyahu. So I don't really see this as much of an opportunity for a full end here. You might get a little break like we had before in February.
60 days maximum, Ronan Kohler, you agree?
I don't know. I don't know. I think that the people in Israel, probably 70 to 80% of the people want the war in Gaza to end. The price that we are paying in lives, in our morality, in our ethics, in our economy, the reservist, the price is totally unacceptable, and I think people want that war to end. I think that the only real reason Netanyahu has to continue the war is to prevent Smotrich and Ben-Gvir from leaving his coalition. And I agree with Michel that if he has enough political power to show that the other option, which is a large deal, the extension of the Abraham Accords, getting the hostages back, which is probably the most important thing for most people in Israel, getting the soldiers back. I think Netanyahu wants that deal. I don't know about Hamas, but I think Netanyahu wants that deal. I think Netanyahu doesn't want to have like an endless war, because if it's 60 days, it can take 600 more days. What is the final outcome?
So in that sense, if Netanyahu wants that deal, he can probably get it. I mean, I think, in other words, if you give Hamas a pathway to ending the war and Israeli soldiers leaving at some certain date, I think they'll go for that. Without that, it's going to be very hard to get them to go for it. They want to take over Gaza again.
if I can just interject, it may be better for Netanyahu, the 60-day deal, and I'll tell you why. Netanyahu doesn't want to come out right now and say the war is over, ceasefire, and then see Hamas claim victory. So the 60 days gives him opportunity to basically have a de facto ceasefire, start letting the hostages out. Israelis will start to see some hope and feel better. And at the end of 60 days, declaring a permanent ceasefire and agreement is not so hard politically. It's not a big step down. And that may be helpful to him to sell it to his base, because who knows? Netanyahu is the first guy to say, who knows what's going to happen in the next 60 days, especially if the Abraham Accords are increased. He's going to go to Washington as a hero. He's going to go to Congress as a hero. You know, he's going to shore up support everywhere. It's a totally different picture now. And he used those 60 days to kind of sell it and step down from it.
In that case, you really could have an end to the war.
Mitchell Barak, was there a window of opportunity where Netanyahu, riding high after the 12-day ceasefire, could have called a snap election that's now gone?
Never, ever, ever do that. Meaning I was working for Netanyahu in the early 90s, from when he was a deputy foreign minister, deputy minister in the prime minister's office and the chairman of the Likud. And we were there in the prime minister's office when he was a deputy minister, and Yitzhak Shamir was the prime minister. And he did fantastically well in the Gulf War. And in fact, he did well. Why? Because Israel didn't respond to the 39 Scud missiles coming in. President Bush, the father, made a great coalition. They defeated the threat, and they had the Madrid Peace Conference. And Shamir thought, let's go to elections. And, you know, he's never been stronger. Well, Rabin took over. Never give the people a chance to throw you out of office or to elect someone else if you don't have to. Just better to stay the course and work on shoring up your government. And he's good at that. He's fantastic as what, like we say in Israel, as finding the next friar, the next sucker. Like P.T. Barnum used to say, there's a sucker born every minute. In Israeli politics, Netanyahu looks for that sucker who's going to join his government and be totally convinced himself that he's saving the people of Israel, even though he can't stand Netanyahu, even though he thinks he should be replaced. And he may shore up more people in his government at this point, and he certainly will have support to do that among the general population.
All right, let's go back to the calculus for a second in Washington, because Nagar Mordozavi, you mentioned the divisions within the Republican Party over how to handle the Middle East. Something of note, oil prices. They're on the rise this Wednesday after Iran's suspension of cooperation with the UN's nuclear watchdog. You heard Hussein Ibish earlier in the conversation saying that, it's a question of just how much has been destroyed with the use of those B-2 bombers by the United States. But what is for sure is that he's reiterated that call to bring the Iranians back to the bargaining table. What's the view on that where you are?
Well, I'm not sure if the attacks really, I mean, nuclear experts are now saying the attacks didn't destroy Iran's nuclear program. The fate of the uranium is unknown. It did damage the buildings, but it could potentially have set it back by months, not even years. What it did achieve is sort of a hardening of position in Tehran, you know, pulling out of the, or ordering or deciding to pull out of the NPT, not collaborating with the IAEA, and essentially less international visibility into a nuclear program, which was civilian when the Israelis attacked Iran. And I also want to sort of give a big picture here. I mean, this may have been, I don't know how much of a victory we can call this, but Israel has been conducting an ethnic cleansing, a genocide in Gaza in the past year and a half. I agree with your other Israeli guests. This has, you know, moral, ethical implications, not just for the Israelis across the region, potentially around the world. Anti-Israeli sentiment because of these images coming out of Gaza is through the roof, not just in the global south, but here, even in the U.S., they have to silence students' encampments with arrests, with threatening to kick students out of the university. So I don't know how this is going to have a good impact in the short term, medium term, or long term. There was sort of a peace, a direction towards a peace or more normalization with Israel as some of its neighbors on their way. And this has unraveled all of that. It has potentially pulled Iran into conflict that can restart any moment. Nothing good comes out of it. And if we, you know, this peace through strength or using hard power in the region has been tried before. We've seen the result in Afghanistan. We've seen the result in Iraq. We've seen the result in Libya. It just brings more instability, more chaos, more insecurity to the region and potentially more armed resistance,
okay, but
which is not really desirable or the path towards peace.
Very briefly, and then I want to ask a follow-up.
Just because you have a picture of the White House, just because you have a picture in the White House in the background doesn't mean what you say is factual. To call again with using the term genocide, in the year 2000, there were 1.3 million Gazans, Palestinians in Gaza. In October 6th, 2023, there are 2.3 million. So I don't know what genocide increases by a million people for starters. We all agree that the number of people killed are about 55,000. No one likes to mention that in that 55,000 is between 20 or 30,000 terrorists. How many do you think there are? How many do you think there are people killed?
Probably about 100,000, I would guess. About 80% of them civilians.
The Gazan authorities are saying the health ministry of Hamas,
children,
Gaza,
at least 15,000 children. We're talking about children. We're talking
out of a population. It's a terrible thing, and every innocent death is a tragedy. But out of a population of 2 million people in a war, to tell me 30,000 people have been killed, it's terrible. But go look at some other statistics.
I didn't tell you that. I told you 100,000.
And the government of that entity, Gaza, is threatening Israel, has hostages, to attack it. So it's a terrible number, but it's really not significant in any kind of urban warfare. And you can't increase the population.
So are you justifying it? Are you justifying the killing of
genocide? You justify
it.
There's not a policy of genocide increasing
it
by a million people.
All right.
Look, I'm not interested in debating whether it's a genocide or not. The policies are genocidal in my view, in the sense that they've targeted people en masse in a way that utterly disregards their ability to survive. Gaza has been rendered basically uninhabitable, right? And I think this is a prelude to depopulation, probably in a piecemeal manner rather than in a gigantic manner. But the point is, look, the percentage of people who have been killed in Gaza who are non-combatants is so much greater than in all the other horrible wars that are going on, including the war in Sudan, the wars in Africa, et cetera. It's off the charts. It really is. This is a particularly brutal war. And you can say, well, Hamas is a particularly brutal enemy. I'm not going to say a word in defense of Hamas. The hell with them. They are largely responsible for this, and they wanted this. I agree with that. But that's no excuse for what Israel has done. And what Israel has done is mass murder on a colossal scale. It's abominable.
All right. The last time Benjamin Netanyahu visited the White House, he had to keep up a poker face when the president announced direct talks with Iran. Nigar Mortazavi, talking earlier about this infotainment aspect of politics these days, particularly when it's the cameras will be rolling next Monday at the White House. Your thoughts on, again, for Donald Trump, is it all about, like he said at the end of that blow up with Volodymyr Zelensky in February, this will make great television? Or is there a plan?
I think the pursuing of diplomacy with Iran and getting a better deal is really the intention of the president. He actually, I would argue, had that intention in his first term, President Trump, but he just couldn't bring the Iranians to the table, and then he unraveled the existing nuclear deal with Iran. But this time, I think he was seriously pursuing diplomacy. Well, he gave himself a very short deadline, which wasn't possible for a deal that complex, but was seriously pursuing diplomacy. And what Benjamin Netanyahu did was to essentially sabotage that diplomacy. I would argue the main goal, or one of the top goals that were reached from the attack on Iran was to sabotage diplomacy. It's not a secret. Benjamin Netanyahu has been trying to sabotage Washington and Tehran diplomacy since the Obama years and after that. And so I think that goal was achieved at least temporarily. And then the attack came. And I think the hope was that the U.S. would get involved and even potentially do more than just a one-time strike. But I think now, again, that MAGA win is... that MAGA wing of the party is sort of having the upper hand, and the anti-war voices have been pushing back. And hopefully the path will go back to diplomacy. I don't know if the Iranians are fully prepared to sort of make a deal as far as what the president, President Trump wants to put on the table. They may come back with a more hardened position this time. But they've also signaled that they're ready for negotiations if there's a serious path to diplomacy. I think, and this is what nuclear experts are saying, the path to ensuring, you know, the only way to ensuring Iran doesn't weaponize its civilian program is through diplomacy, nuclear talks, and these sort of international monitoring and safeguards. No bombing can achieve, you know, the destruction of the know-how, of the knowledge, of the science, and also the determination. There are plenty of mountains. They're going to go build it somewhere else if it's a clandestine program. And so it's important to prioritize diplomacy and to pursue it seriously and to not allow Benjamin Netanyahu to sabotage it with another set of attacks.
Ronan Kohler, are you optimistic, pessimistic?
I'm neither. I am hopeful. I think there is enough reasons to be hopeful that things are going to change and the state of Israel is going to get back on track to become an amazing country like we have been for so many years, and the Middle East would go back on track to become a place that is advanced and modern. I'm hopeful. I think we can do it.
All right, we'll have to leave it there, unfortunately, but it's nice to leave on a hopeful note. Ronan Kohler, many thanks for joining us from Ribeauvillé in Alsace. I want to thank as well Mitchell Barak in Jerusalem, Hussein Ibish and Nigar Mortazavi in Washington. Thank you for being with us here in the France 24 debate.